Hello, I'm Lucia Gardner.
And my name is Luke Solcenti.
And this is Looking In with Lucia and Luke. This episode's topic is textile art, intimacy and confrontation.
So today we're talking about two artists, the first being Mieke Warners. She's a Dutch textile artist working in embroidery and sculpture with a main focus on materials such as wool, flax, and silk. Her work is observant of the human form in relation to time and aging, as well as the tactile and textural qualities of her subjects.
Dejic Brackens, located out of Los Angeles, California, is a textile artist most known for his narrative woven tapestries that explore themes of the artist's life and their African-American and queer identity. Brackens employs techniques from West African weaving, quilting from American South and European tapestry making to create both abstract and figurative works.
And to speak with us on this issue today, we have our first guest with us, Ren. Would you like to introduce yourself? Maybe speak a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, sure. Hi, my name is Ren McLean. I am a fine arts and art history double major here at the College of New Jersey. I focus in my own profession a lot on works that question both the utilitarian function of objects as well as their artistic qualities and how a object having utilitarian function might take away artistic value and vice versa. I have worked with textiles in my own career. Recently, I've been getting into rug making, specifically tufting. So I would love to hear you guys talk about it and, you know, have a dialogue.
Thank you so much for being here. We kind of titled this episode Intimacy and Confrontation because that's kind of the thing that these two textile artists have in common.
I definitely see that because I know I was the one who brought Dejic to the table, and as you said, his work focuses a lot on the African-American experience as well as how that relates to queerness. His work actually obscures the human form by like creating full body silhouettes. So it's really interesting how we can see these really intimate interpersonal connections with these people, just to kind of see how we can make these connections without having those specific details of the gaze to really reinforce that. When looking at Mieke's work, her like most recent stuff seems to be focusing on the nude form of like elderly bodies to kind of highlight the beauty of growing old and aging. So it's interesting comparing these two artists, of one being very hyper aware of the body and the details of it, while the other simply just uses the gestural and the idea of the body, have these very similar ideas of connection and the human form.
I think that's some great points that you're bringing up. With Mieke, they're looking right at us. We're focused on the gaze, not necessarily how they take up space all the time. You look at Dejic's, and this is a moment to look at the way the shape interacts with the textures and the other things around that figure.
It's really interesting because any type of artwork seems to have like the human figure being the most prominent, I want to say centric part of a work of art. And I know it's really interesting because a lot of people don't consider textile work to be art. They consider it to be more of a craft, especially historically speaking. And to me, that's absolutely wild because you're looking at some of this stuff and the realism, the pictorialism, and just the pure detail put into many of these works would argue otherwise. I don't know how you could ever just consider this, you know, just a craft and not a different type of fine art.
I think that kind of ties into what I focus in my own practice of the utilitarian function of a lot of these craft arts, quote unquote. You might look at Dejic's work and see that because it's weaving, you'll connect it to tapestries that are historically made to keep homes insulated, or rugs to keep floors clean, or blankets to keep you warm. But then when those are kind of removed from those utilitarian functions, then what's left is this, like you said, pictorial form of art making. And then what does that mean for the value? There's this hierarchy of materials where different materials are seen as more valuable than others. So fabric arts and craft arts aren't seen as valuable as, say, sculpture that is carved from a fine stone like granite or marble, or paintings that are specifically like oil-based.
There's a lot of things that play into that. It has to do with, number one, accessibility, and the fact that there's a quote on Deidrick's website that says, textile work is exciting audiences again, because the field of makers has expanded. It is an expansive space where women, queer people, and Black and brown folks have made huge contributions historically and presently. It starts to make you think how accessible these things were to people who weren't considered, you know, at the top of the food chain. These weren't white men that were primarily historically making tapestries, that were making rugs, that were making all these things. They were women. They were Black women. They were, you know, they were people of color. I think it comes with this elitism that for so many years, art was also about men and male artists and those mediums that they worked in, painting and sculpture.
Oh, for sure. I even know historically that watercolor paintings were very prominent among women as a sort of pastime, you know, especially because I forget what exactly the time period was. For a lot of noblewomen, it was expected that you be well-versed in multiple different things, one of the things being art, to kind of show that you could help teach your children these very high intellectual concepts and be a good mother. So like watercolor was very prominent among like noble women and just women in general as a pastime. But then later, white male artists started to actually experiment in watercolor because they recognized the artistic qualities of it. And then that was when watercolor started to actually be recognized for its artistic qualities within the larger canon of art. So I think part of that too is just boils down to, of course, misogyny in a lot of why craft arts are not as higher valued in fine arts as they are being recognized currently, because we're actually starting to recognize how misogyny and racism actually contributes a lot to the ways that we don't recognize certain art forms as valuable as others.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's why I love that a lot of these things are coming to light now. And we're saying, okay, who is this unknown quilt made by? Like, what communities have made these things? Despite all of the growth that I think we have made in art communities, I think people weaving or doing embroidery still kind of get that thing of, oh, you made this, how can you market it now? It's not like, how can you put this in a gallery, you know? And it's like, I think as artists that are students that don't really have an art career, quote unquote, yet, we hear that a lot, no matter what medium we're using. But despite its recognition that it's getting in galleries, the mass public still sees it as a way to contribute to capitalism.
Yeah, I wanted to preface, I'm not trying to get too political, but I do find that idea of feeling compelled to constantly market yourself is less of a craft arts problem and more of a problem within our capitalist society, because you can be a digital artist, in-person artist, where you could do craft arts, you could do sculpture, you could do painting, you can do whatever. But there's still that idea that unless you market yourself in some way and make replicas of your work, or don't make replicas, but instead sell those individual pieces, your work does not have value, because we don't seem to have that intrinsic artistic value in mind, only that monetary value. So maybe in that way, that's partially why fiber arts doesn't have value in the higher arts field currently, or at least is only now starting to be better recognized in the finer art field. There's that idea of just the material being tied to its past and the historical connotations of certain materials.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because two other art forms come to mind that in their conception kind of had that same battle, but you know, evidently they found a more streamlined way to be marketed and to, you know, find a place in this capitalist society. So they didn't, you know, have as much trouble as all as some of these art forms. And specifically, I'm thinking more of like photography, film, and animation, which are just about 100 years old, I think, respectively. But because, you know, their marketing potential and the absolute explosion of an industry around them allowed them to flourish and, you know, not face any type of scrutiny for how they would be, you know, portrayed. Animation is still kind of fighting a interesting battle where, you know, a lot of people perceive it as, you know, children's work, but the money that comes from that industry is absolutely ludicrous when you look at it. So a lot of people are beginning to you know, place serious emphasis on franchise work, on anything that could exist for past one person's lifetime and continue to make someone an incredible amount of money. And typical fine art just doesn't do that. It's not meant to do that, first of all. And second of all, a lot of people don't create things like that. It's just not how you think.
I think the reason why photography specifically has had a difficult time kind of defining itself as both a fine art form and a art that is used in commercialism is because it kind of replaced painting's role as a thing to capture real life. And of course, that idea is flawed too, because we shouldn't view photos as a one-to-one to real life, because they're not. They are just a recreation of what we can physically see. But it's this overemphasis of how a recreation of real life is somehow representative of real life, which I think that's an issue with a lot of work too, where there's this emphasis of realism in fine art, of like painting or sculpture being seen as better by, of course, the masses compared to things that are more abstract or figurative. With animation specifically, I do think that is more of an American problem, specifically because American companies have kind of cornered the market of animation being for children.
That's a really good point. So let me ask you guys this then. Do you think that any country, but I guess we could just say the United States because it's where our viewpoint is, if they found out a way to market textile and tactile art in the same manner they, you know, can with film and animation, do you think that it would like explode in the same way?
I definitely think it would, because it would then open a lot of people up to the idea of making textile works, because currently there is that sort of mindset that only old ladies do textile art. You know, you become a grandma once you start to knit, once you start to embroider, once you start to make little like felt dog toys for your grandkids. So there's that connotation of these fiber arts being women's crafts. And of course, that's historically what they have been, because that was what was acceptable for women to do. Women couldn't really paint. And when they could, it was watercolor. Women couldn't really sculpt. Women did some collages, but then that was even taken over by like modern male artists. So I feel like it would explode in a similar way, where it would be a lot more people would be into it and would be interested in exploring the broad mediums within fiber arts. But I feel like there is already that marketability of fiber arts in terms of textiles for blankets. I mean, there's already that big boom of people making textile wall hangings. People are really getting to rug making recently, which is funny because I know I'm getting into rug making. So it's just people tend to get into things at the same time, because especially with our, you know, connections to social media, people are able to be a lot more upfront with their interests in certain mediums, then inspire others to get into it as well. I definitely feel like now people are really getting to fiber arts more than they ever have been, because we've kind of helped to break down that barrier of fiber arts is for old ladies.
Right. I kind of think
old ladies are awesome.
I just bought a shirt at Walmart that says grandma life is the best life, $5. I know we're not doing like promoted things in this podcast, but I just want to say, you know, like that's really cool. And I love grandmas. But what I was going to say about the topic is that I don't really know if it can be marketed in the same way, textiles, the same way that photography and animation can be. Just because textiles lack of connection to the digital world. However, I don't personally have TikTok, but like TikTok during a pandemic has really made this kind of idea of like making things in the home and craft way more popular and way more accessible. There's so many videos of tutorials now that you can figure out in just a matter of seconds, and you can say, wow, okay, now I'm going to try to felt a duck keychain, or this person just showed me one of the ways to stitch on embroidery, and now I'm going to try this out. There's so many people figuring out ways that you can make things in the home, or just kind of introducing people how you can do these things without it being like an expensive and hard thing to do. So everyone's realizing, wow, I can be an artist and I can make these own things for myself and enjoy myself.
I think the accessibility that TikTok and like all social media has had on the art world has allowed a lot of people to get into mediums that they otherwise wouldn't be able to. But because of that idea of anybody being able to get into it, for some reason, that seems to devalue certain art forms. If a work is being able to be replicated, does that somehow take away its own artistic qualities because it's not a singular? I mean, Lucia and I, we have a background in printmaking as well during college. So we know this idea of replicas somehow making artworks have less value to them as pieces, which I know her and I also don't quite feel. Even photography and animation and filmmaking aren't super accessible. They used to cost so much money to get the right cameras, the right film, the right programs to animate, or the time. Time is super important when it comes to those works. I mean, animation takes a lot of time. Even if you animate on like paper and like using paper and pencils, that still takes so much time, and you know, time is money. Part of that too is we even see that photography has been devalued as an art form because, and I don't personally think that, that's just how it is in the sort of larger art market, because everybody has the ability to take photos and to make films because they have their phones that have built-in camera and video components. There's easy ways to edit them. So I think that's more of a problem with our society viewing art that is able to be accessible as not being as valuable, which is also partially why I think a lot of oil paintings and realism is seen as more valuable in our current art field, just because there's that inherent idea of there's more time being put into it and it's not as accessible, because an average person couldn't just pick up a paintbrush and paint a person that looks almost one-to-one. The fact that accessibility is the marker for what makes art valuable in our current art market is what I think is kind of messed up, and also partially why fiber arts has not been as valued up until now.
I think this starts to ask questions about modernism. Just because anyone can do it, does that mean it's not art? Does that mean it's not good, kind of thing? Okay, you could do it, but you didn't. You could do it, but why didn't you? And it's raising questions about individualism, especially in a capitalist society. We're encouraged to think of ourselves and think of ourselves above other people and communities. So if I can do this thing that's hard, why should someone be getting recognition for something that's easy? I just think that's a weird thing to think about. And that's not always our fault for feeling that way, or, you know, I think we're encouraged to feel that way. Yeah. How do you guys feel about that in relation to maybe your own practice as student artists, or just relating to this topic today?
I'm actually really happy you brought that up, because I feel like in my own personal, conquest as an artist, that's kind of something I've been trying to solve. And even with my upcoming thesis, I think it's going to be my main focus point. Although technology and art has become really accessible for a lot of people, what that kind of happens is it not diminishes the quality, but technology makes, you know, things easier to do. So, it, you know, you put less learning time into it per se. So you're not as focused as the fundamentals. You're not as focused with understanding whatever tools you might be using. And sometimes, you know, you see a lot of work that someone creates and it's like, it might not display a full, you know, set of knowledge as all those types of fundamentals. And, you know, people really respond to those, whether it's form or concept or colors or value or anything like that. That stuff is very important. And I think that ultimately is what separates a lot of art in a way, I guess you could say, from professional to casual work. And I think it gets really confusing because sometimes work that doesn't adhere to those fundamentals sometimes becomes popular and it confuses us. And we might be like, well, why is this thing that someone put such little time and effort to, how is this making a lot of money when something I'm breaking my back to do isn't right. getting recognition, especially if it's something like social media, which is completely arbitrary and based off like algorithms and just, you know, circumstance that you happen to find this video as opposed to seeing someone else's. I think it's entering a really weird gray area where it's we're kind of losing what the definition of art is in a way. But it might not be a bad thing in the long run, because it might just, you know, force us to take a step back and be like, well, this is what's important to, you know, art, and this is what's important to us, and this is what we want to see out of these things, which evidently we're seeing a lot more than just the stereotypical forms of art, like painting and photography can display, like textile art and fabric arts.
It's also important to say at the end of the day, like, okay, maybe this specific thing isn't art, but that doesn't mean it's not creative. And we should be encouraging children and just everyone, adults, to be creative overall and not be so afraid of getting involved in creativity, things that actually will help them think in a different way than just focusing on how am I going to get a job?
Yeah. Luke, I think you were kind of touching upon this idea of time equals value, which is interesting too, because I know in my own practice, if I can do something fast, like if I can make something in less time, I will do that because I recognize how valuable my time is. And it's not that if I put more time into a work, it will get more value, but instead I value my time more than I value, in the end, what is an object, what is something that I make, but has arbitrary meaning depending on who views it. So I think there's always been that idea too, that technology is going to be the downfall of art, because there's this idea that if we don't put our all into work, that suddenly it doesn't have that value to it, which personally I think isn't true, because the more time people have to think of conceptual things, the more time people have to build a body of work, the more time people have to experiment is much more important than the time it takes to make one. If I could make a work in 5 minutes versus 5 hours or 5 days or 5 years, I would rather do it in the 5 minutes. So of course, it just depends on your own personal view of what gives a work value, if that is time or if that is end results. But I do feel like in the end, technology and the ability to make works faster will make the art world a lot better, just because it will allow for more work to be created, more work to be discussed, more people to get into it, because a big hurdle for a lot of people getting into art is they don't have the time. There's always those people who say, oh, I wish I could draw, but I just don't have the time. I wish I could be as good of an artist as you, but I just don't have the time to learn. Sometimes it's not about trying to be the best at something, but instead trying to, you know, just experiment and try it out.
Yeah, there is a really sick notion that we have in our society, really, that's connected to that capitalist point, where if it's like you're going to do something, you need to know how to make money from it, and you really need to know how to do it the best and so forth and whatnot. But you don't need to master everything you do. It doesn't need to be perfect, and you don't need to continuously compare it to other people's, especially if you're not trying to not do anything with it. But like if it's not your career, and if you're not, it's not this big part of you, then it, you know, it doesn't need to take that brevity as it would to maybe someone else. And that's fine. A hobby is super important, but just for, like you said, with, you know, expressing oneself and thinking creatively and thinking differently.
I kind of want to talk about Daedric's work and like the narrative quality of it. I noticed a lot of his work, he really relies on the aspect of a title and kind of like this poetic aspect of naming something. How does that change the context or really define a work in a different way? What do you guys think about that?
I think that in recent years, titles have kind of gone to the wayside, partially because artists have wanted the viewers to be able to interpret works as they want, especially if they are more abstract and anyone could interpret it in any specific way that they so choose. But I feel like titles with his work are really important, partially because of the topics he does cover. And you wouldn't necessarily want topics about race and sexuality, as he is a queer Black man. He wouldn't want the meanings of his work to fall through because they are so important. There's one work of his, The Bravest Sons, that is really interesting to me, because I'll describe the image for those who are listening, but also I would highly recommend you looking it up. It is one one figure sitting on another, kind of horsey style, not sexual, but like the other person is on all fours walking around like a horse. And then the person who is sitting on top has a rainbow boa on. So then without the title, you might not be able to make this idea, like the connection that this work like is clearly about someone who is gay, gender nonconforming, some sort of queer who is being able to express himself and in that way is the bravest of the sons of the family. So is there is the idea of bravery and being able to be your true self in your queerness that otherwise might not have come through without that title.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites of his too. I just love artists who are able to express themselves both visually and through writing. So it feels so clever to me that he can say the bravest sons. And I love his exploration with color. Like it is very specific that this boa or whatever you want to call it around this person is rainbow. We know what, at least as a modern viewer, what this means in relation to the work. And in relation to the artist itself, but also the figures, the two figures are different colors. We see that the person that is, as we sort of described as like in horsey position, but not sexual, is gray, while the person that is assumably the bravest son, pure black.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting separation of the figures as well, because in most of his other works, from what I can tell, the figures are black, which I read as a relationship between black people and his own sort of history and his own like communication with others. So while I could read the gray or horsey figure as another race, I could also see it simply being a way to distinguish the two figures, because he doesn't seem to use many defining lines to just define parts of the body beyond just whatever the silhouette would sort of allow.
Yeah. Personally, if I'm being honest, I think titling one's work is kind of like a mini art form in itself. It could do so much to help the piece. And it's like, I have to say it, like, I want to say it goes along with the same mindset of like critical thinking and understanding like what the purpose of your own piece is at, you know, at its core, which sounds like a silly thing and that it might not be too difficult, but I don't know. I think it really says a lot for the image.
No, I completely agree. And I just want to say that that doesn't mean that works that don't have a title or don't stress on the title aren't as equally amazing, interesting, or introspective. But I do think there is something to be said about an artist that chooses for the viewer to decide versus an artist that says, I want you to understand my work. And like what that says about a person, what that says about your wants and the psychology of an artist. I don't know. That kind of aspect is interesting to me.
Yeah. I'm someone who loves titling their work. And even in my own work, I use a lot of text that doesn't explicitly state things, but it's just enough to maybe, in my eyes, start a conversation with the viewer and the art itself. So that's where I see it as. And then, of course, also appreciate anyone who does the exact opposite and just throws it up there and says, you know, have a visual experience with this thing, you know, have your own relationship with it. It's cool how you can do diametrically opposite things, but still kind of come out with a similar artistic experience, you know, just your own personal relationship and conversation in your mind with whatever they've created.
That kind of brings me to Mike's work, because they did title a lot of their work, but a lot of this stuff was actually hard to find, because where you find their work was just a little more like, it was just harder to find, mostly because they are primarily a Dutch artist that works, you know, like where they're from. They don't really work abroad. They don't work in the United States. However, just because I don't know the names of the work, or I don't know the ones that I have seen the name of, just because I don't know what that word means, doesn't mean that I can't look at their work critically and see that maybe there are things that they wanted the viewer to notice. For example, something that I was really interested in by their work is their fixation on hands. And I think it's important to bring this up. In the day and age that we're in, like hands in art, high art, and I don't want to say low art because that sounds bad, but you know, like art that's not in galleries slash like isn't being defined by an artist. people love to draw hands. And I think part of that is just because this is this thing that's attached to our body and like, it's fun. But how can we look at an artist's fixation on hands from a historical art perspective? I see the way that they're looking at age and the way that they're looking at portraiture slash like the human figure. And I think about the Renaissance painting with Adam, the two hands touching.
Oh, I believe it's called the Birth of Adam.
Is it? That's the painting that most exactly people in the audience should know. So it's funny that I cannot remember what it's called.
Yeah, I have it on a shirt and I can't remember.
Creation of Adam. Yes, it is the Creation of Adam. But it's like the divine aspect of hands and their history in that way, where like you're at the right hand of the Father, these religious references versus like, okay, is there a hierarchy with this artist bringing up hands? Or is it just that they work with their hands all the time? Is it a connection to process?
I just think hands are such a meta thing to make in art, because hands are the oldest tools. They are probably one of the things that have made us able to evolve to the point of like conscious thinking beyond just survival. So I think it's really interesting that artists have this fixation with hands, partially because of the sort of meta qualities of using these tools to then depict these tools, but also because the qualities of connection, as the title reflects, connections to other people. We hold hands, we groom one another, we like brush each other's hair, we touch each other. It was just, hands are a big part. And now I'm talking with my hands. I know those who are listening can't see that, but just thinking about hands is making me use them to talk. We communicate with hands. And even there's, of course, ASL, where we literally use hands to communicate when words can't. So I think it's really interesting how artists will use hands as both a sort of connection to something that is difficult to recreate, because it is a very intricate thing of all these little digits on a sort of circular meat thing connected to another long meat thing. But also because of those, the inherent idea of connection and humanity that comes with hands, because one thing that really kind of defines if something is real is if we can touch it. So I just think that's interesting too. And even how you brought up the creation of Adam, how there is this idea of the divine of hands, and how there is that idea of hands being directly linked to creation and humanity and connections with either each other or some higher being. We use hands to pray, and even similar things, like hands are just so involved in our daily lives, and both in artistic imagery and things beyond that is really interesting.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, it's crazy because in Mieke's work too, I'm trying to figure out what she used to create these. Is it like silicone? Is it?
Oh, she's a wet felter. So wet that's felt. When you have like wool, and then you get it wet, and then you're able to use a needle or sometimes your hands to kind of mat the fibers together to create sheets. It's essentially just wool sheets that she has used with raw wool. Well, not raw, but it's processed to make it sure it's clean and manageable. To then, like, have you ever seen a felted stuffed toys? That's typically what they're used for like little figures and whatnot. Well, I think a lot of modern artists would probably go for a silicone model because that'd be more direct of a one-to-one where you could model somebody's body. I think it is interesting that her and a lot of other felting artists will, of course, use felt to kind of create this fibrous, textile, tactile quality of the work that sometimes you might miss out on a more smooth medium like you would with silicone or some other like plastic.
And then you want to touch it. And this goes back to this whole conversation.
I do.
That we're having about touch and our connection as humans with it. I just, yeah, it's making my brain work right now and think a lot.
Yeah, because I feel like if I touch it, it'll be similar to like the Halloween masks or like, you know, those type of props, because it's got the same eerie quality as them. But that's definitely not what you would get if you touch them. You might feel like a remnant softness of like blankets or warmth, which would be super off-putting considering how they look.
Yeah, I think that's also part of the strength with her using felt, because it's inherently warm as something that is made of, you know, hair, even though it's not our hair, it's animal hair or fur and wool. So there is that sort of odd quality to it as well, where it's something that is warm, but visually might not be as appealing because it can kind of look like somebody was skinned, which is off-putting to those who aren't really prepared for it or for the concepts that she's putting through of appreciating the human form, especially as it ages, because too often in our culture, especially in America, we view youth as the sort of pinnacle of beauty, and you're only beautiful when you're young, and if you're not young, you need to strive to look young. So it's an interesting thing she's exploring with kind of emphasizing and appreciating the older human form, especially older women, in a way that is often misinterpreted or not really shown in art.
Yeah. Love it. Love all of it. I think we're just about good to wrap up. Is there anything else you guys want to throw in before we're done?
Ren, I'm so glad that you could make it today and talk with us.
We really appreciate it.
No problem. I hope I was able to help.
Yeah.
So thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Is there anything you might want to plug before you're done? Art you're doing, websites?
Yeah, I'm currently working on an art website, like my artist website. It's not currently up, but when it will go up, it will be under my artist pseudonym, Ren Rullo, R-E-N-R-U-L-L-O. That is also the handle for my Instagram, Ren Rullo, R-E-N-R-U-L-L-O. No spaces, no underscores, nothing like that. Feel free to check out my work.
Oh, heck yeah.
Awesome.
Looking In with Lucia and Luke is a podcast brought to you by the College of New Jersey's ArtsCom digital team. If you liked this episode, join us April 16th for an interview with TCNJ senior visual arts major with a specialization in fine arts, Jalen Giles Yule, where we will talk about their practice as an artist, as well as the upcoming senior thesis exhibition, In Flux, coming to the TCNJ Art Gallery this May. Thank you.